This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents By Gaslight by Stephen Price. Read for you by John Lee.
For Cleo and Maddox, and in memory of Ellen Seligman. If a man is willing to accept the consequences, there is nothing that need limit his effectiveness. All that we remember will one day be forgotten. Take everything. Adam Fool. I really and truly think I can handle this man. I can make him useful to us. William Pinkerton. The Woman in the Thames. Part 1. 1885. London. 1. He was the oldest son. He wore his black moustaches long in the manner of an outlaw, and his right thumb hooked at his hip, where a Colt Navy should have hung. He was not yet 40, but already his left knee went stiff in a damp cold from an exploding Confederate shell at Antietam. He had been 16 then, and the shrapnel had stood out from his knee like a knuckle of extra bone, while the dirt heaved and sprayed around him. Since that day he had twice been thought killed and twice come upon his would-be killers, like an avenging spectre. He had shot 23 men and one boy, outlaws all, and only the boy's death did not trouble him. He entered banks with his head low, his eyebrows drawn close, his huge, menacing hands empty, as if fixed for strangling. When he lurched aboard crowded streetcars, men instinctively pulled away, and women followed him with their eyelashes, bonnets tipped low. He had not been at home more than a month at a stretch for 5 years now, though he loved his wife and daughters. Loved them with the fear a powerful man feels who is given to breaking things. He had long yellow teeth, a wide face, sunken eyes, pupils as dark as the twist of a man's intestines. So, he loathed London. Its cobbled streets were filthy even to a man whose business was filth, who would take a saddle over a bed and huddle all night in a brothel's privy with his Colt drawn until the right arse stumbled in. Here he had seen nothing green in a month that was not holly or a cut bough carted in from a countryside he could not imagine. On Christmas he had watched the poor swarm a man in daylight, all clutched rags and greed. On New Year's he had seen a lady kick a watercress girl from the step of a carriage, then curse the child's blood spotting her laces. A rot ate its way through London, a wretchedness older and more brutal than any he had known in Chicago. He was not the law. No matter. In America there was not a thief who did not fear him. By his own measure he feared no man living, and only one man dead, and that man his father. It was a bitter January, and that father 6 months buried, when he descended at last into Bermondsey, in search of an old operative of his father's, an old friend. Wading through the night's fog, another man's blood barnacling his knuckles, his own business in London nearly done. He was dressed like a gentleman, though he had lost his gloves, and he clutched his walking stick in one fist like a cudgel. A stain spotted his cuffs that might have been soot or mud, but was not either. He had been waiting for what passed for morning in this miserable winter, and paused now in a narrow alley, at the back of snowfields, opera hat collapsed in one hand, frost creaking in the timbers of the shop fronts, not sure it had come. Fog spilled over the cobblestones, foul and yellow and thick with coal fumes, and a bitter stink that crusted the nostrils, scalded the back of the throat. That fog was everywhere, always, drifting through the streets and pulling apart, low to the ground, a living thing. Some nights it gave off a low hiss, like steam escaping a valve. 6 weeks ago, he had come to this city to interrogate a woman who, last night, after a long pursuit across Blackfriars Bridge, had leaped the railing and vanished into the river. He thought of the darkness, the black water foaming outward, the slapping of the yard sergeant's boots on the granite setts. He could still feel the wet scrape of the bridge bollards against his wrists. She had been living lawful in this city as if to pass for respectable, and in this way absolve herself of her complicated life. But as with anything, it had not helped. She had been calling herself LaRoche, but her real name was Reckitt, and 10 years earlier she had been an associate of the notorious cracksman and thief Edward Shade. That man Shade was the one he really hunted, and until last night the Reckitt woman had been his one certain lead. She'd had small, sharp teeth, long white fingers, a voice low and vicious and lovely. The night faded, the streets began to fill. In the upper windows of the building across the street, a pale sky glinted, reflected the watery silhouettes below, the passing shadows of the early horses hauling their wagons, the huddled cloth caps and woolens of the outsides perched on their sacks, the iron-shod wheels chittering and squeaking in the cold. He coughed and lit a cigar and smoked in silence, his small, deep-set eyes predatory as any cutthroat's. After a time he ground the cigar under one heel and punched out his hat and put it on. He withdrew a revolver from his pocket and clicked it open, and dialed through its chambers for something to do, and when he could wait no longer, he hitched up one shoulder and started across. If asked, he would say he had never met a dead nail, didn't want to go straight. He would say no man on the blob met his own shadow and did not flinch. He would run a hand along his unshaved jaw, and glower down at whatever reporter swayed in front of him, and mutter some unprintable blasphemy in flash dialect, and then he would lean over and casually rip that page from the reporter's ring-coil notebook. He would say lack of education is the beginning of the criminal underclass, and both rights and laws are failing the country. A man is worth more than a horse any day, though you would never guess it to see it. The cleverest Jake he'd ever met was a sharper, and the kindest Jill a whore, and the world takes all types. Only the soft-headed think a thing looks like what it is. In truth, he was about as square as a broken jaw, but then he'd never met a cop any different, so what was the problem and whose business was it anyway? He did not go directly in, but slipped instead down a side alley. Creatures stirred in the papered windows as he passed. The alley was a river of muck, and he walked carefully. In openings in the wooden walls he glimpsed the small, crouched shapes of children, all bones and knees, half-dressed, their breath pluming out before them in the cold. They met his eyes boldly. The fog was thinner here, the stink more savage and bitter. He ducked under a gate to a narrow passage, descended a crooked wooden staircase, and entered a nondescript door on the left. In the sudden stillness he could hear the slosh of the river, thickening in the runoffs under the boards. The walls creaked like the hold of a ship. That rooming house smelled of old meat, of water-rotted wood. The lined wallpaper was thick with a sooty grime any cinder man might scrape with a blade for half a shilling. He was careful not to touch the railings as he made his way upstairs. On the third floor he stepped out from the unlit stairwell and counted off 5 doors. And at the 6th, he stopped. Out of the cold now, his bruised knuckles had begun to ache. He did not knock, but jigged the handle softly, and found it was not locked. He looked back the way he had come, and he waited a moment, and then he opened the door. "Mr. Porter," he called. His voice sounded husky to his ears, scoured, the voice of a much older man. "Benjamin Porter, hello." As his eyes adjusted, he could see a small desk in the gloom, a dresser, what passed for a scullery in a nook beyond the window. A sway-backed cot in one corner, the cheap mattress stuffed with wool-flock bursting at one corner, the naked ticking cover neither waxed nor cleaned in some time. All this his eye took in as a force of habit. Then the bed groaned under the weight of something, someone, huddled in a blanket against the wall. "Ben! Who's that now?" It was a woman's voice. She turned towards him, a grizzled Negro woman. Her grey hair shorn very short, and her face grooved and thickened. He did not know her, but then she blinked and tilted her face as if to see past his shoulder, and he saw the long scar in the shape of a sickle running the length of her face. "Sally," he said softly. A suspicion flickered in her eyes, burned there a moment. "Billy?" He stepped cautiously forward. "You come on over here. Let me get a look at you. Little lantern box, Billy. Goodness, no one's called me that in a long time. Well, shoot, look at how you've grown. Ain't no one dare to."
He took off his hat, collapsed it uneasily before him. The air was dense with sweat and smoke, and the fishy stench of unemptied chamber pots, making the walls that much closer, the ceiling that much lower. He felt big, awkward, all elbows.
"I'm sorry to come round so early," he said.
He was smiling a sad smile. She had grown so old.
"Rats and molasses," she snorted. "It ain't so early as all that. I was just in the city. Thought I'd stop by, see how you're keeping."
There were stacks of papers on the floor around the small desk, the rough chair with its fourth leg shorter than the others. He could see the date stamp from his Chicago office on several of the papers, even from where he stood. He could see his father's letterhead and the old familiar signature. The curtains, though drawn, were thin from long use, and the room slowly belled with a grey light. The fireplace was dead, the ashes old, an ancient roasting jack suspended on a cord there. On the mantel, a glazed pottery elephant, the paint flecking off its shanks. High in one corner, a bubble in the plaster shifted and boiled up, and he realized it was a cluster of beetles. He looked away. There was no lamp, only a single candle stub melted into the floor by the bed. He could see her more clearly now. Her hands were very dirty.
"Where's Ben?" he asked. "Oh, he would have wanted to see you. He always did like you." "Did I miss him?" "I guess you did."
He lifted his face. Then her meaning came clear.
"Oh, now," she said, "it's all right."
"When?"
"August. His heart give out on him. Just give right out."
"I didn't know."
"Sure.
My father always spoke well of him." She waved a gruff hand, her knuckles thick and scarred.
"Why didn't you write us? We would have helped with the expenses. You know it." "Well, you got your own sorrows."
"I didn't know if you got my letter," he said quietly. "I mean if Ben got it. I sent it to your old address."
"I got it. Ben Porter. I always thought he was indestructible. I reckon he thought so himself."
He was surprised at the anger he felt. It seemed to him a generation was passing all as a whole from this earth. That night in Chicago, almost 30 years gone, the rain as it battered down over the wagon, the canvas clattering under its onslaught, the thick waxing cut of the wheels in the deep mud lanes of that city. He had been a boy, and sat beside his father up front, clutching the lantern box in the rain, struggling to keep it dry and alight as his father cursed under his breath and slapped the reins and peered out into the blackness. There were a group of 11 fugitive slaves, led by the furious John Brown, and they had hidden for days in his father's house. Each would be loaded like cargo into a boxcar and sent north to Canada. They had journeyed for 8 weeks on stolen horses over the winter plains, and had lost one man in the going. He had known Benjamin and Sally and 2 others also, but the rest were only bundles of suffering. Big men gone thin in the arms from the long trek, women with sallow faces and bloodshot eyes. Their wagon had lurched to a halt in a thick pool of muck just 2 miles shy of the rail yards, and he remembered Ben Porter's strong frame as he leaned into the back corner, squatted, hefted the wagon clear of its pit, the rain running in ropes over his arms, his powerful legs, and the strange, low sound of the women singing in the streaming dark. Sally was watching him with a peculiar expression on her face.
"You're going to want some tea," she said.
He looked at her modest surroundings. He nodded.
"Thank you. Tea would be just fine."
He made as if to help her, but she shooed him away.
I ain't so old as all that. I can still walk on these old hooves.
She got heavily to her feet, gripping the edge of one bedpost and leaning into it with her twisted forearm, and then she shuffled over to the fireplace. She broke a splint from a near-toothless comb of parlor matches and drew it through a fold of sandpaper. He heard a rasp, smelled a grim whiff of phosphorus, and then she was lighting a twist of paper, bending over the iron grate, the low rack of packing wood stacked there. The bricks, he saw, were charred, as if she had failed to put out whatever fire had burned there last.
"How you take it?"
she asked. "Black."
"Well, I see you got your lumps already."
She gestured to his swollen knuckles. He smiled. She was wrestling the cast-iron kettle over the grating.
"You moved,"
he said delicately. He did not want to embarrass her.
"I didn't have your new address."
She turned back to look at him. One eye scrunched shut, her spine humped and malformed under her nightgown.
"You a detective, ain't you?"
"Maybe not a very good one. What can I do to help?"
"Oh, it'll boil in just a minute. Ain't nothing to be done."
"I didn't mean with the tea."
"I know what you meant."
He nodded.
"It ain't much to look at, but it keep me out of the soup. And I got my old arms and legs still working. I ain't like to complain."
He had leaned his walking stick against the brickwork under the mantel, and he watched Sally run her rough hands over the silver griffin's claw that crested its tip, over and over, as if to buff it smooth. When the water had boiled, she turned back and poured it out, and let it steep, and shuffled over to the scullery and upended one fine white china teacup.
"You say you been here working?"
she called out to him.
"That's right." "I allowed maybe you been looking for that murderer we been reading about. The one from Leicester?"
He shrugged a heavy shoulder. He doubted she was doing any reading at all, given her eyes.
"I've been trailing a grifter. She had a string of bad luck in Philadelphia. Ben knew her."
"Sure."
"I caught up with her last night, but she jumped into the river. I'd guess she'll wash up in a day or two. I told Shore I was here if he needs me, at least as long as the agency can spare me." "Who's that now? Inspector Shore?"
"Chief Inspector Shore." She snorted.
"Chief Inspector? That Shaw ain't no kind of nothing."
"Well, he's a friend."
"He's a scoundrel."
He frowned uneasily.
"I'm surprised Ben talked about him,"
he said slowly.
"Wasn't a secret between us, not in 62 years. Especially not to do with no John Shore."
Sally carried to him an unsteady cup of tea, leaned in close, gave him a long, sad smile as if to make some darker point.
"You got yourself a fine heart, Billy. It just don't always know the cut of a man's cloth."
She sat back on her bed. She had not poured herself a cup, and he saw this with some discomfort. She looked abruptly up at him and said,
"How long you say you been here? Ain't you best be getting on home?"
"Well,
you got your wife to think about."
"Margaret, yes. And the girls."
"Ain't right, being apart like that."
"No."
"Ain't natural."
"Well,
you gonna drink that or leave it for the rats?"
He took a sip, the delicate bone cup in his big hand. She nodded to herself.
"Yes, sir. A fine heart."
"Not so fine," he said. "I'm too good a hater for much." He set his hat on his head, got slowly to his feet. "Like my father was," he added. She regarded him from the wet creases of her eyes.
"My Mr. Porter always telling me, you gotta shoe a horse. Best not ask his permission."
"I beg your pardon.
You going to leave without saying what you come for?"
He was standing between the chair and the door.
"No,"
he said. "Well, I hate to trouble you." She folded her hands at her stomach, leaned back thin in her gray bedclothes.
"Trouble,"
she said, turning the word over in her mouth.
"You know, I'm going to be 83 years old this year. Ain't no one left from my life who isn't dead already. Every morning I wake up surprised to be seen it at all. But one thing I am sure of is next time you over this side of the ocean, I like to be dead and buried as anything. Oh, now dying is just a thing what happened to folk. It ain't so bad. But you got something to ask of me? You best ask it.
He regarded her a long moment.
Go on. Out with it.
He shook his hand.
I don't know how much Ben talked to you about his work, about what he did for my father. I read your letter. If you come wanting them old papers, they are still there at his desk. You welcome to them.
Yes. Well, I'll need to take those.
But that ain't it.
He cleared his throat. After my father passed, I found a file in his private safe. Hundreds of documents, receipts, reports. There was a note attached to the cover with Ben's name on it, and several numbers, and a date. He withdrew from his inside pocket a folded envelope, opened the complicated flap, slid out a sheet of drafting paper. He handed it across to her. She held the paper but did not read it.
Ben's name gonna be in a lot of them old files.
He nodded. The name on this file was Shade. Edward Shade. She frowned. It was in my father's home safe. I thought maybe Ben could help me with it. A brougham clattered past in the street below.
Sally,
he said.
Edward Shade. Shoot. You've heard of him. Ain't never stopped hearing about him.
She cast her face towards the weak light coming through the window.
Your father had been hunting that Shade over here for years. Never found nothing on him. Not in 10 years.
She looked disgusted.
Everyone you ask got their own version of Edward Shade, Billy. I won't pretend what I heard is the truth.
I'd like to hear it.
It's a strange story now.
Tell me. She crushed her eyes shut, as if they pained her. Nodded.
This was some years after the war, she said. 67, 68. Shade, someone calling himself Shade, done a series of thefts in New York and Baltimore. Private houses. Big houses. A senator's residence is the one I heard about. Stole paintings, sculptures, such like. All them items he mailed to your father's home address in Chicago, along with a letter claiming responsibility and naming the rifle owner. Who was Edward Shade? No one knew. No one ever seen him. It was just a name and a letter, far as anyone known. First packages come through, you fatty. He returned them on the quiet to the owners, and get a heap full of gratitude in turn. But when they keep on happening, some folk, they start to ask questions. All of it looking mighty suspicious, month after month. Like he was orchestrating the affair to make the agency look more efficient. Some daily in New York published a piece all about it. Kept it going for weeks. That newspaper was mighty rough on the agency. It embarrassed your father something awful, it did.
I remember something about that.
Sure. But what else was he going to do? They were stolen items. Ain't no choice for a man like your father but to return them rightfully back.
Yes.
And then the case broke, and the whole affair got cleaned up. Turned out Shade weren't no one after all. There were a ring of bad folk had some grudge against your father. They was looking for some leverage, and if that weren't possible, they was hoping to embarrass the agency out of its credibility. Edward Shade, that was just the name they made up.
But he had been hunting Shade for years after.
Right up until the end. Your father had his notions.
None of that was in the file. Sally nodded.
Worst way to keep a secret is to write it down.
Ben ever mention a Charlotte Reckitt? Sally touched two fingers to her lips, studied him.
Reckitt?
Charlotte Reckitt. In the file on Shade, there was a photograph of her. Her measurements were on the back in Ben's handwriting. There was a transcript attached, an interview between Ben and Reckitt from 79. In it, he asks her about some nails she worked with, someone she couldn't remember. Ben claimed there were stories about them in the flash houses in Chicago,
but she didn't know what he was talking about, or claimed she didn't. He left it alone eventually. Diamond heists, bank heists, forgeries circulating through France and the Netherlands, that sort of thing. According to my father's notes, he was certain this nail was shade. In September, I sent out a cable here and to Paris, and to our offices in the West with a description of Charlotte Reckitt. Shore got back to me in November, said she was here, in London, where my father had been on the payroll.
Billy.
Before he died, the last time I saw him, he looked me in the eye and he called me Edward.
Billy.
It was almost the last thing he said to me. She looked saddened.
My Mr. Porter got mighty confused himself at the end, she said. You know, I loved you, Father. You know, my Mr. Porter and me, we owe him our whole lives. But that Edward Shade, now, you take them papers, go on. You read them and you see. It ain't like your father made it out to be. He were obsessed with it. Shade were like a sickness with him.
He studied her in the gloom. I found her, Sally, the woman I was following last night, the woman who took her life. It was Charlotte Reckitt.
Shoot!
I talked to her before she jumped. I asked her about Shade. She knew him.
She told you that?
He was silent a long moment, then he said, quietly, not in so many words. Sally opened her hands.
Oh, Billy,
she said, if you hadn't the breath in a man, what is it you huntin'? He said nothing.
My Mr. Porter used to say, every day you wake up, you gotta ask yourself, what is it you're huntin' for?
Okay.
What is it you're huntin' for?
He walked to the window and stared out through the frost and soot on the pane at the crooked rooftops of the riverside warehouses, feeling her eyes on him, the sound of her breathing in the darkness there. What are you seeing? That Shade doesn't exist. She shook her head.
There ain't no catching a ghost, Billy.
When does a life begin its decline? He thought of the Porters as they had once been, and still were in his mind's eye. The glistening ribcage of the one in the orange lantern light and the rain, wool-spun shirt plastered to his skin, his shoulders hoisting that cart up out of the muck. The low, plaintive song of the other as she kneeled, coatless in the waters. He thought of the weeks he had trailed Charlotte Reckitt from her terrace house in Hampstead to the galleries in Piccadilly. Trailed her languidly down to the passenger steamers on the Thames, watched in gaslight the curtained windows of her house, hoping for a glimpse of Edward Shade. She was a small woman with liquid eyes and black hair, and he thought suddenly of how she had regarded him from the steps of that theatre in St. Martin's Lane, one gloved wrist bent back. The fear in her eyes. Her small hands. She had leaped a railing into a freezing river, and they would find her body in the morning or the day after. So. He would be 39 years old this year, and he was already famous and already lonely. In Chicago, his wife was dying from a tumor the size of a quarter, knuckled behind her right eye, though neither he nor she knew it yet. It would be another 10 years before it killed her. He had held the rope as his father's casket went in and turned the first shovel of earth over the grave. That scrape of dirt would echo in him always. Whether he lived to 80 or no, the greater part of his life lay behind him. When does a life begin its decline? He stared up at the red sky now and thought of the Atlantic crossing, and then of his home. The fog thinning around him, the passers-by in their ghostly shapes. Then he went down to Tooley Street to catch the rail line back to his hotel. His name, yes, that. His name was William Pinkerton. 2. Here is another. His eyes would fill with light, even after a light was extinguished, like the eyes of a cat. They were violet and hard as amethysts, and they liked the darkness. His side whiskers he wore fashionably trimmed, though the deep black in them had long ago bleached to white. Though it had been a bad crossing, even during the roughest weather, he had sat in the smoking room of the RMS Sorania, turning the ironed pages of the Times with a wetted finger. He had been seen thus and thus, only by men who mattered. His skin a light brown against the starched white collars, his long fingers. Seen in tailored suits and expensive fitted waistcoats, as if a jeweler or industrialist, just back from Bombay, although in truth he had fallen on hard times, and when he crossed his legs, he would first hitch a pinch of trousers up his thigh with a worry for the thread. But his cufflinks were emerald set in gold leaf, his tie pin studded with diamonds. Asked if any line existed between how a man looked and what a man was, he would smile a sad, knowledgeable smile, as if he had lived a long time and seen too much of the world for certainties to be conceded. Go on. No, he was no liar. He just was not what he seemed to be. He was traveling with a little girl he would introduce as his daughter. His voice was soft and curiously high. His mother had been born in a narrow house in Calcutta, and at 13, and still unmarried, had made her way along the banks of the Hooghly River to the sea. Her burnished skin gleamed in his own face and throat on sunlit days. The shadows around his eyes were the purple of cold water anemones. He was small, the way she had been small, with strong narrow shoulders and thick wrists. And though all his childhood he had heard tales of his Yorkshire father's great size, he had never known anything of it. He had lived among the very poor and the very rich both, and he knew which world he preferred. Despite all this, he lived with a sharp impatience for anything that broke the moral law, for that law he believed was absolute, and took the one measure of all who drew breath on God's earth. No man should embrace violence. No man had a right to hold any other back. Those in need must be cared for. If pressed during a round of whist, he might confess that truth, in his experience, was just a lie refined into elegance, and that nothing in this world was sacred, though all things in the next world might be. In an age of industrialists and blue bloods, he was a self-made man and not ashamed to say it. For 23 years now, he had answered to the name of Adam Fool. He had already made his fortune and wasted it several times over. In certain banks along the eastern seaboard, his name was now anathema. In others, it remained respected. In still others, managers would hurriedly unhook their wire spectacles and stand at their desks to consider his newest venture. An elegant club in New York held an oak-paneled room in reserve on weeks when he walked in that city, though he had not settled that bill in 3 years. His business was multifold and various, and suitably vague in an age of gentlemen investors, and he did not advertise his talents. He had been away from England only 6 weeks, and it was a letter in a woman's handwriting that had drawn him back so soon. On what business? What else? No wealth is ever sufficient. He stood now at the railing, feeling the engines of the ocean liner thrum up through his feet, then slowly punched down stage by stage through their gearings. There were others on deck in the cold, though not many, and all of them stood wind-racked and wrapped in thick scarves or deck blankets emblazoned with the Cunard logo, and each huddled with arms at their chests, clutching their morning coats closed. He was dressed in last season's fashions, a double-breasted tweed, a lounge coat buttoned fast, a brown bowler lifting in the wind. He felt his whiskers stir and raised his eyes. The sky was overcast, but bright off the white hulls of the lifeboats where they hung in their casings above the deck. To the east he could see Liverpool, like a smudge of ink against the grey. The factory chimneys, their brown smoke standing off angular in the wind. Just then a child came through the saloon doors, pulling at the lace of her bonnet, not quite 11 years old. "For God's sake, Molly," he called. "Look at you! Your boots!" The soft leather was scuffed with red chalk on the toes and up along the laces, as if she had been kicking God knew what.
"Do I look a sight?"
she said with a grin.
"Come here."
Her cool eyes, her freckled nose. She flounced against the railing, folded her elbows over. The wind pressed her dress, crackling against her legs, and he could see the boyish shape of her hips through it. He knew her buttoned gloves concealed fingernails ragged and bitten. He reached around, tied her bonnet more firmly.
"What's that smell?"
she asked. Stop squirming.
Creosote.
She mouthed the word. Did the porter collect the bags? He asked.
I left them in the hallway, like you told me to.
As I told you to. As. After a moment, Fool held out an empty hand and she blinked her dark eyes at it.
What?
You know what? She found and reached into her sleeve and withdrew the 5-pound tip he had given her for the porter, and she handed it across.
I like you better when we're rich, she said.
He took it wordlessly. But as she turned to look out at the river, something caught his eye and he reached into the folds of her dress, withdrew a small plaster doll.
Where did you get this?
He demanded. She snatched it back, suddenly feral.
Is that the doll the Webster girl was playing with? It's not.
He turned and studied the crest of foam unfurling away from the hull, and then looked at her again.
What's got into you? She don't know it from me. That's not the point.
The girl was blushing. She would not meet his eye.
You want me to give it back?
What do you think?
Then they'll know it were me what took it.
He shook his head. She was silent a moment and studied her boots in the Mersey silver brightness, and then she looked at him.
Anyhow,
she said sullenly,
she got lots of others.
He looked past her. A thin man in a funereal topcoat and black hat had come out and was standing with one hand on the heavy door of the smoking lounge. He squinted into the wind towards them, then raised a hand in greeting and let the door swing shut. The whitewashed deck was wide and alcoved with brass spittoons riveted into place, and porthole windows gleaming in the grey light, and as he approached them, his dark reflection passed, warpling alongside. Molly followed Fool's gaze over her shoulder, then gave him a look, and muttered something, and then, with a sarcastic curtsy, she slid away, beating her gloved hand on the railing as she went. Her other hand clutched the doll at the neck as if to strangle it.
Be at our cabin in 10 minutes, he called to her. Molly? I mean it.
She raised an arm in the wind without turning round.
Your daughter?
The man said as he approached.
A handsome girl, sir.
I did not see her on the crossing. Fool raised his hands in defeat. The gentleman laughed.
I have nieces aplenty myself, sir. One can see the breeding at once in her. Her mother is
dead,
Fool said quietly. He waved a hand.
Time goes on, though our hearts may not wish it.
She must have been a great beauty, sir.
Fool cleared his throat.
I mean in her lineaments,
the man went on.
Certainly your daughter appears to have many advantages. She is an excellent specimen.
Specimen?
The gentleman laughed.
Forgive me, I have been so long in my work that I lose the language of the everyday.
It is a hazard.
What did you say it was?
Phrenology.
He nodded in satisfaction.
Phrenology, sir.
Yes,
the science of human potential.
Forgive me, what line did you say you were in?
I didn't.
Clearly not
whist.
At last Fool smiled too, though ruefully.
I'd hoped at some point these past days to win some of it back, he said. I'd hoped at least to get close.
I had been hoping that also for you, sir.
Wasn't in the cards, I guess.
The phrenologist cleared his throat.
If I may be so bold.
Fool reached into his vest and unclipped the chain and held it out, weighing it in his palm.
It belonged to my father, he said. It is exquisite.
It was a silver watch, built in Philadelphia 20 years past, with a single band of copper encircling its face, and filigreed with a delicate latticework of gold inlay, in the shape of an unblinking eye. At a click, the lid lifted, and there, etched as if in copperplate, was the inscription, For My Son. He clicked it shut.
If you would be willing,
Fool began,
I'd be pleased to send you the funds upon my arrival in London.
The phrenologist held up a regretful finger, the joints crooked and swollen. His eyes had scarce lifted from the watch.
I am sure I can depend upon you, sir,
the phrenologist said, but it is the principle of it, you understand. A man cannot just sit down at a table and outplay his hand without meeting the consequences. The phrenologist was nodding now. Sadly, there are always consequences. He went on, that is the point. That is what I wish to impart to you. It is how we keep our honor, sir, here in England.
Of course. I only just thought, perhaps...
Ah, no. He was a tall man, though thin, and he stepped forward now and loomed over Fool. There was in his gesture both threat and coiled restraint, and Fool felt the railing bite into his ribs, and he cleared his throat, and then he gave the man the watch. Something sharp and painful turned over inside him as he did so. The phrenologist held it up to the light, opened it, closed it with a click, then shut his claw-like fist around it and slipped it into his waistcoat in a single smooth motion. Fool made a pained face.
I always clear a debt, he said.
Indeed, sir. Fool turned and regarded the low roofline of the landing stage at Pierhead, the wide planked boardwalk just coming visible there, the dock offices looming up behind. Upriver he could see the squat, sooty brickwork of the Albert Dock. The air felt cold, grim.
And how long do you mean to stay in Liverpool, sir, if I may be so bold?
The phrenologist asked.
You'll be staying at the Adelphi, I trust?
We're travelling up to London this evening. On the London Northwestern.
Excellent. Excellent. May I recommend the American bar at the Criterion in Piccadilly?
Fool grunted.
And you are returning home, I take it?
To my practice, yes. I have been visiting a most fascinating collection of Indian skulls in Boston. Most remarkable.
Fool watched the fingers of the man's left hand shift in his waistcoat, turning and turning his watch.
It is an instrument of some personal value,
Fool said after a moment. He nodded at the man's pocket.
Perhaps we might negotiate it back, at some future date. At interest, of course.
The phrenologist withdrew his hand from his pocket, smoothed his whiskers, peered out at the cranes and tackles swaying on their ropes at the freight docks.
I think we might come to some agreement, sir. I would not wish to deprive you of something you value so highly. This is my visiting card. Should you ever have need of a physician in Liverpool, or simply wish to pass an evening in company, I should be delighted.
I fear I couldn't afford it. The evening, that is.
You might win your timepiece back.
I might lose my shirt.
The phrenologist made a show of inspecting the smaller man's collar and cuffs. He said with a smile. Not likely. Fool was all at once tired of it. The dark outlines of the ramps, the arcades of the landing pier, slid nearer. The phrenologist regarded him.
You do not have the spirit of a gambler, sir.
Fool smiled tightly.
No one does, he said.
It was a steel-plated behemoth, inclined to roll with a displacement of just over 7,000 tons, and a single screw and twin smokestacks that ran hot. The crossing had taken all of 11 days, despite the black weather, and the hull had lifted and crested the cold slate swells, then crashed, breaking down out of the roll, then lifted again until no man on board had not been sick at least the once, and the dining hall had thinned to a man. It was rigged as a bark, and bore one mast fore and two aft, like a memory of an earlier age, but its opulent saloon was all polished brass and riveted leather, like the fittings in some modern post-war paddle-wheeler off the Mississippi. Every second evening a French magician worked his sleight in top hat and evening dress, while a lady accompanied him on the piano. Each night before he slept, Fool would take out a small brown envelope and unfold the letter within, and reread it in silence, with his lips mouthing the words, and then he would listen to Molly snoring softly, and slip the letter back into the envelope, and slide the envelope under his pillow. Her handwriting had changed in the 10 years since he had seen her last, and he thought of who she would be now, fearing, from her tone, that she had fallen onto hard times herself. She wrote with a gentleness that surprised him, given their past, and made no mention of wrongs done, of betrayals made. Each morning he gripped the polished railing of his bed and felt the vessel's sway, and thought how much closer he now must be, and something stirred in him that he had not felt in a very long time. Among those who lurched into the breakfast saloon were an American senator he recognized from the newspapers and a burly doctor from Edinburgh, who laughed loudly among the men, but when ladies were present, conducted himself with impeccable politeness. He seemed to know something about everything, and would speak at luncheons of bare-knuckle boxing and the rightness of the British Empire and of recent oracular surgeries in France, and at nights would posit the possibility of spirits, and Fool had liked him immensely from the very first. One evening he complained of detective stories dependent on the foolishness of the criminal, rather than the intelligence of the detective, and Fool had smiled at the simplicity of it. But the doctor only chuckled and said, "Deduction, my good man, deduction." He was one among them who had gathered late into the night to play whist, and while the drinks shifted elliptically to the swells, and the men had smoked and laughed, only the doctor had kept his true self hidden. The doctor, that is, and Fool. For no man he met kept better counsel. 5 days out, and Fool had grown used to the bite of the salt air, and the plummet and lift of the deck, and he would take his evening constitutionals leaning into the wind, then come in soaked to the skin, and clapping his frozen hands, and Molly would shake her head at him in disgust. None of that mattered now. The days had passed. England neared. By late morning, the liner had docked and lashed its twin gangways fast, and Fool watched the trunks and crates of the saloon passengers twist slowly in their nets above the wharf. Any who leaned over the upper deck railing would see the steerage boiling up out of the guts of the vessel, a roiling crush of families and workers and drifters, dragging suitcases or sacks, some gnawing sticks of sausage, others clutching the necks of bottles, a sea of slouching grey caps and brown bonnets and faded shawls, lost, and then again visible under the low grey drifts of steam, while the great boilers below decks clocked down. Fool made his way through the saloon and down the marble staircase to the second level, and along the wide, gaslit hallway to his and Molly's second-class cabin. There were porters and passengers milling about, and some fixing their hats in the hurry, and he twisted the heavy latch of his door, but he did not see the child. "Molly?" he called. The stateroom was empty, the bedsheets turned back and pressed, the mahogany desk already cleared to a shine. He saw their luggage had been picked up, and he cursed himself for having left no tip. He set the £5 down on the desk, then thought better of it, and pocketed it again. A crewman knocked at his door and called out the minutes, and went on. He stood studying his face in the small mirror bolted to the wall. The lines at the corners of his eyes like a fine web of cracklore. The white hair, the dark worried forehead, the already thorny eyebrows. When did he get old? What would she say to see him now? What would she say? A shudder passed up through the hull. After a moment he set his bowler, sharpened his starched cuffs, took up his cane and went out on deck. The offloading had already begun its slow shuffle forward. The saloon class had been nearly full, with a list of 96 passengers registered, and Fool pressed through those who were loitering until he had joined the rear of the disembarkation line on the gangway. He did not see any sign of Molly, but knew she would be near, somewhere in the crowd. He worked his way up until he was standing behind a huge man in a homespun coat, canvas pants, a tattered leather trunk hoisted on one shoulder. He could smell the boiled sausage reek of the man's skin, the grey rime of filth at his neck. Everywhere around them were the manicured and tailored figures of men of standing. A customs agent in white was inspecting tickets at the first stage on the pier, and he stopped the giant and lifted his paperwork in two fingers, turning it in the light. "You're in the wrong class, sir," the agent said. "How did you get up here?" Fool heard the giant mutter some word, and then the agent lowered the ticket. "I beg your pardon." The giant was sullen, silent. "You will exit from down there, sir," the agent said. He pointed below at the crowd of third-class passengers, crushed together and hollering against the press of unwashed bodies. Fool's eyes followed his gloved finger down. The giant shrugged one massive, meaty shoulder and turned sideways. He might have been a bare-knuckle boxer for all the look of him.
Excuse me, sir, Fool called ahead. Surely you might let the fellow through? We do have engagements to keep, sir.
The agent turned. Are you with him? The giant gave him a glower. Fool held up both hands, the cane hooked over a thumb. He made as if to take a step back, and was surprised to find a space had opened at his back.
I will not be dictated to, the agent was saying. Not by you, sir, and not by the likes of this.
The likes of what now?
The giant said.
The agent sniffed and peered past him. Step aside, sir. Next.
My papers are in order.
Next.
No one moved. All at once the giant slid his big trunk onto the ramp, and then, in a single coiled gesture, he unfolded the front of the custom agent's waistcoat in his hand and half-hoisted the man into the air. He was whispering into the man's ear, and Fool could see the alarm in the agent's eyes as he looked sideways at the giant, looked away. The whitewashed ramp, with its slatted stops just beyond the gate, the roiling crowds exiting from steerage. He felt suddenly very tired. But he stepped forward all the same.
All right now, he said. That'll do.
Feeling something sinking inside him as he did so. The giant's shirt was open where the collar did not fit his throat, and he held a proofed bottle, half concealed under one stained sleeve, even as he dangled the agent above the decking. The lips under his black beard were red and wet.
Put the man down, Fool said. This is not fit behavior, sir.
The customs agent spluttered, his pink tongue, whites of his bulging eyes, the brass buttons of his collar glinting in the daylight like coins.
You, the giant snapped, you shut your mouth. It ain't your concern.
Fool nodded unhappily. He could smell the garlic on the man's breath. He had thought some other might step forward with him, but he stood alone. He could see Molly's red bonnet dipping and weaving behind the crowds massed there, as if she were trying to get closer. He felt something like dread pass through him, very hot, then very cold. He altered his grip on his cane.
Put him down, he said more firmly.
Everything went still. The vessel at its moorings, the crowd, the gulls swarming the air of the docks below. The giant took a deep breath. He shook his head. With his free hand he leaned across, and before Fool could react, he shoved him lazily, and the force of it was tremendous and sent Fool staggering back, with his arms wheeling, to keep his balance.
I said to shut it.
Fool rubbed at his coat. A sudden flare of anger rose in him, and he stepped forward. He pushed at the giant as hard as he could, square in the big man's back. The giant dropped the customs agent and turned. He stared at Fool in astonishment.
And what do you reckon you're doing?
He said in a low voice, all at once uncertain. His eyes flicked over the assembled crowd.
There are ladies present, sir, Fool said loudly. There are witnesses. Step down, sir.
A look of confusion slid like a shadow over the giant's face, and then it was gone. Fool took a deep breath. He tightened his grip on his walking stick. And then, without warning, the giant lurched forward and was upon him. Lifting both fists, thick as a block of tackle, and swinging them overhand, as if to stove in Fool's skull. The man was thick in the waist, and leaned his weight in behind him, and he moved fast despite his size. But as the fists came down, Fool stepped smoothly back, and then to the left, feeling the whoosh of air in the space where he had stood, and then he raised his cane and brought it sharply down on the giant's temple in two quick strikes, and the big man went down. There was a cracking sound, like a rivet punching from an iron boiler. Fool watched a dark blister of blood swell just behind the giant's eye, where he lay with his face twisted to one side, and then on the decking under his beard a wall of blood began to seep outward and down through the steel joinings. A stunned silence passed over the crowd, then a whirl of voices, shoving elbows, faces drained of blood.
"Dear God, man!"
a porter was shouting.
Give them air! Give them air!
Fool let himself be jostled aside. After a moment, he stepped to the railing with his back to the maelstrom and stood very silent, very still, as the gulls wheeled and plunged in the air just beyond the ramp. Far below him he could see the yellow waters of the Mersey boiling under the hull. On the silver head of his cane, a small bead of blood glistened like oil, and he saw this and withdrew a starched handkerchief and rubbed it thoughtfully away. It was a woman's letter had brought him back to England. On what business? What else? He had eyes the color of irises in bloom, and wore his pale whiskers trimmed, and said nothing of consequence to anyone. In an interior pocket of his steamer trunk, he kept wrapped in an old woolen scarf, an ancient daguerreotype, framed and battered and long since clouded into grey. A young woman in crinoline and bonnet, seated, half obliterated, in an open door of a studio, his younger self standing behind her, while the sunshine gleamed off a balcony railing beyond them. The heat of that sun long since burned off, her face long since faded, eaten into whiteness, a slash of shadow where her lips and eyes had once frowned out. It did not matter. He knew that visage in its every line and curve. Her throat, he recalled, had smelled of wild raspberries in summer. That daguerreotype was taken in September of 1874 in the bustling harbour city of Port Elizabeth, South Africa. He had been poor then. The photographer's name was De Hook, and his studio a dim warren of rooms just north of the public gardens, reeking of fixative and other jars of chemicals, standing with lids half unscrewed behind a curtain in a back room, just out of sight. Fool had sat in a corner, clutching her shawl in his fists, as the man adjusted his lenses, and as she sat sorrowful in her beauty, and then he had stood and joined her. It had been her last week in Africa, his last week with her. He understood she was living somewhere in London and unhappy in that life. She would be 30 now, and no longer as she had been. Did it matter? It did not matter. Her name was Charlotte Reckitt, and he had loved her once, and loved her still. 3. William Pinkerton crossed the narrow lobby of the Grand Metropolitan Hotel without checking in at the front desk for the post. There was a man in a flat-topped bowler reading a broadside under the dwarf palms, where the brass railing of the bar met the lobby, and he saw the man and how the man looked at him, but he did not slow. He felt light-headed, thin in the throat, a shivering in his hands as he went. The gaslights were gleaming in the brass and the mirrors and the marble underfoot, and something in all this made him sick. When the gate of the lift folded shut behind him, the operator nodded and pulled the lever, and the lift creaked under his big weight. But the operator did not ask his floor. He could see as they ascended the man near the palms fold his paper, tuck it under one arm, stride out through the lobby doors. At his room, the door opened at a touch. He felt the hairs on his neck prickle. "Hello?" he called in. The air was hushed. "Show yourself," he called more sharply. After a moment he grimaced and dropped his walking stick and hat on the pier table in the hall and shut the door. He was making himself crazy, he thought. The papers from Sally Porter were rolled tight under one elbow, and he understood he had reached the limit of something. He unrolled the papers and opened the shallow cigar drawer and put them away. Stepped back onto the mat and scraped his shoes wearily on the horn, slipped off his Chesterfield, slung it on the oak coat tree. In the small drawing room to the left, he could see the dim shapes of sofas, cane chairs, aproned side tables, all crouched and waiting. He ran a hand along the back of his neck. Benjamin Porter was gone. It did not seem right. He knew the world was not a place of rightness, and yet something in his visit to Sally had left him uneasy. He could feel the old melancholy settling in, the slow, depressed weariness of an investigation closing. He was this way always after finishing a case, restless and brooding, left wandering room to room in his house in Chicago like a man just risen from a sickbed. Margaret knew not to speak to him at such times, knew to leave him to his loneliness and gloom. But this was different. Since slipping from Sally's room, he had been unable to shake the feeling of a figure just ahead of him, exiting each space as he entered, almost visible. "Ain't no catching a ghost," Sally had said, both of them knowing which ghost it was. He had not loved his father in life, and he did not love him in death. But grief, he knew, was a heavier thing than love between the living and the lost. The maid had been in. He did not know the hour, but thought it still early. The mattress had been turned, sheets and bolster changed. The green curtains in the bedroom were open on their brass rods, their folds waterfalling in elegant swags on either side of the big front windows. He walked the length of the room, scraping the curtains on their rings shut. The room darkened, window by window, until only thin stripes of daylight fell aslant the floor, where the curtains failed to meet. But when he turned, he could still see the wet heel prints his shoes had left on the carpet. He did not care. He thought of Sally Porter's decaying room and felt ashamed. In the middle of the floor stood an old-fashioned four-poster bed carved from Spanish mahogany and big enough for two. William peeled off his cutaway and withdrew his tie-pin and loosened his tie. Then he lay down on top of the bedclothes and closed his eyes. He did not unbutton his waistcoat, did not unloop his starched collar, did not draw the heavy drapery shut around the bed. In the dimness, the grey face of his wife stared out at him from her silver frame. He awoke to a hammering at the door, to a muffled voice calling for him. He rolled over, shut his eyes, pulled a frilled pillow over his face. When he next awoke, the sound of the knocking had altered. A high, reedy voice was calling to him through the wood.
"Mr. Pinkerton, sir? Mr. Pinkerton?"
He wet his lips.
"Are you awake, sir? Mr. Pinkerton?"
He opened one slow eyelid.
"Sir, Chief Inspector Shaw sent me."
He got groggily to his feet and peered about at the room, recognizing none of it. He could hear the faint clatter of horses in the street outside, the sound of hawkers shouting from the corner of the square. It was still morning.
"Sir?"
"Just a minute," he barked. When he unlocked the door and opened it, he found a boy in corduroy trousers, a heavy jacket, a squashed cap of wet red wool. Not 10 years old, if a day. His raw-looking nose was slick, and he licked at his glistening upper lip and blinked twice, and then he took off his cap. His fingernails were black. William did not know him. He glanced along the corridor in both directions and then glowered down at the boy.
"Persistent little devil, aren't you?"
"Sir?"
"What time is it?"
10:30, sir."
"You weren't knocking earlier?"
"Sir?"
He shook his head.
"Never mind. What's this about Shore?"
The boy straightened.
"If you'll come with me, sir, it's something you should see."
"What is it?"
"If you please, sir. He said not to tell you."
"You're a runner from the yard?"
"Yes, sir."
"Has he recovered the body?"
"The body, sir."
A door opened across the hallway. A man with red hair and waxed mustaches emerged in his shirt sleeves, and there was ink on his fingers, and William glared at him, then ran one bruised hand down his face.
"For God's sake,"
he said, steering the boy by one shoulder out of the corridor.
"This better be about Charlotte Reckitt."
He was not, officially, in London. He had arrived on the last Friday in November when the Chicago office had slowed for the season, and that date now was already 6 weeks gone. It had been the first Christmas with his father dead, and he thought of his daughters guiltily, and of his wife's recriminating letters with sadness. His brother had written from the New York offices, wondering at his absence, but he had not written back. After their father's funeral, they had spoken little, but as brothers, it had never been their way, and it did not mean what it might have. Robert was the second son and could do little right in their father's eyes, and William knew this, and watched his brother at the cemetery, feeling a heaviness in his throat. They had gone over their father's office at the Agency for Outstanding Business, but there had been little for the old man to do in those final months, and his desk had been uncommonly tidy. Robert had taken a brass statuette of a racehorse from the bureau. Nothing else. All that July, William had slept badly and worked long hours, while the daylight lingered, in an attempt to quiet his heart. But nothing, it seemed, could do so. At last, in September, he went alone to their mother's house and ate a quiet dinner with her, while the candles blazed in their sconces.